People in Myanmar are casting their ballots in the first election since a military coup ousted the civilian government in 2021. It's taking place amid a civil war and one of Asia's worst humanitarian crises.
The vote is further complicated by the fact that the junta doesn't control the entire country. It's fighting a civil war that, according to the UN, has killed over 6,000 civilians and displaced millions more.
Voting is taking place in three phases over the course of a month, but only in areas held by the governing military junta. That's estimated to be less than half the country, with the rest under rebel control. The military has barred prominent opposition figures from running.
Unbelievably, the world is ignoring one of the most important movements of our time. The struggle for justice, dignity, and freedom unfolding in the heart of Myanmar. The guests we bring on our podcast platform refuse to look away. Instead, they dive deep into the stories that matter, of resilience and resistance, of ordinary people standing up against extraordinary odds. While the headlines may move on, we seek out voices and perspectives that are all too often overlooked. And so we believe that Insight Myanmar is more than just a podcast. It's a platform that seeks truth, connection, and solidarity. And we're glad to have you with us.
Welcome back. This is our second interview in English with Myanography and looking at the details and ethnographic research regarding the three phases of the sham election that the military recently carried out. In today's episode, we are going to be focusing on the events and the irregular application of the three phases of the election themselves. And in the final episode, we will be discussing the aftermath of the electoral process. But before we get into that, my guest today is Caleb, and I want to thank you very much for coming and sharing your research and your insights. I want to give you the opportunity to introduce yourself and maybe for the audience who missed the first episode, go through briefly what Myanography is.
Okay. Hello, everyone. Yeah, my name is Caleb, and currently working with Myanography. And in our recent election focused research project, I involved as the research coordinator. And as we know, the military organized election was completed in three phases, and we monitor this election in 16 locations of 12 states and region. So In our study, it is found that the voter turnout is very low, and particularly in Hakha, which is the capital city of Chin State. In Hakha, the whole town, which silent strike on election day in the first phase, election day was on Sunday, so people didn't even go to church on that day, and only a few number of government survey staff participate in the election. So overall, this military junta planned election was largely driven by fear, coercion, anxiety, and uncertainty. So that is generally what we found in this during in our studies.
Mm. And I think it'll be logical if we go through this day by day by day. So let's focus on the first day. So all of this will be available if anybody wants to look up the Mianography reports. I think I accidentally said Mianocracy. Mianography reports, Understanding Myanmar from Within. There are three separate reports, one concerning each of the phases of the election. And so the first report is the first phase of the election. So that took place on the 28th of December of 2025. And let's just, before we even go into that, has this really been done before in Myanmar, this idea of running an election in different phases where each part of the country votes on a different date? Is this something that has happened before, or has this been invented just for this sham election?
As far as I know, this was the very first election that implemented in different phase. You know, we have never had such kind of election before, and I think such kind of election is cannot be for in any other place as well.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And so this is an election that is very, very piecemeal. So as you note, it's not even done by state and territory by territory. Even within individual divisions or individual states, only part of each division and part of each state voted at the same time. So if I'm understanding correctly, you've looked at 9 different locations for the first day. Broadly speaking, what is it that you found when you researched the first phase of the election?
In the first phase of election, as I briefly mentioned earlier, we found that the people of Myanmar did not want to participate in this election. They didn't support this election, but some people went to the police station and cast their vote because of the due to the fear of possible security risks or repercussion if they abstain if they do not participate in this election. And there's also a reason why they have such kind of fear, because since before the election, the local residents have been pressured directly or indirectly, for example, those who participate in the CDM, they were they were told by ward administrator that they were told indirectly that when one of our local researcher from ARV, when she visited to the local administration office to get recommendation later, she was told by the administrator that the list of CDM participants is still in the office, and your husband is also, in the eligible age group for conscription. So since before the election, those kind of indirect pressure were imposed to the civilian. So before that, our local researcher was determined not to participate in the election, but after she was told like that, she became to realize that voting would be a safer option for herself and her family, and not only CDM participant, also ITP people were also directly called by phone by the administrator, and they were told to come and vote on election day. And those household with young people, they were also They are not told directly, but rumors are circulated in the community that those who do not participate in the election will be targeted for, forced military service, something like that. So, and other business people or shop owner in the wards, in the community, in the village, they were also, worry about being shut down their home shop, their other business activity. So there is for such kind of concern, some people participate and vote in this election, and that is what we found in our first round of the election focus studies.
Mm. So there's quite a lot going on there. And one thing that I find very interesting is that, as you're saying, the voter participation is actually legitimately quite high. This is not, it seems, one of those instances where the voter participation is very low, but the military will announce 97-98% of eligible voters participated. This seems to be an instance where legitimately a very large number of people went to the polls because they had fear that if they do not go to the polls, then they or their families or their businesses are going to be targeted, harassed, arrested, forcibly conscripted into military service, and so on and so on and so on and so forth. And so this is a very interesting change in tactic by the military. So I have a few questions on this. And the first is, mm-hmm. have the military announced the electoral participation percentages? And if they have, are the numbers that they announced realistic?
According to my experience, military, the data released from the military regime is not reliable. They just, they always do propaganda, they don't announce the real information, real data. So the voter turnout information also cannot be trusted, announced by the military regime. So we if the turnout voter turnout is announced by any other that committee, any other that organization, it should be reliable, or we can trust from such that party. But military information released from the military is not trustworthy, so we can trust what they announce. And according to our research as well, only one third of the, we can generally say that only one third of the village population or what population were participated in this election. Some people, there were pressure, but some people still didn't participate in this election. Mm. So if we compare to the previous election, the voter turnout is still very low.
So you say one third is your estimate of eligible voters who participated?
If we can say roughly, yeah. And
roughly.
Yeah, roughly. And in Mudong, which is Omo State, one of our local researchers also mentioned like that only one third of the local population, village population, go and vote, go and cast their vote. So there are some reasons why voter turnout is low. As the first thing is, people, they themselves do not interested in this election. They don't support this election. And another thing is, the voter list is not correct. Many people are missing. Name of many people are missing. Generally, only about two people in the family are included, and some people who already passed away, some old people who are already passed away are also stay in the list in some case. And so the incorrect encoded voter list is another case why voter turnout could be another case where voter turnout is low. And another reason is just before the election, the military local authority distributed voting slip, you know, a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So distributed to selected individuals. So those who didn't receive, mostly those who didn't receive those slip did not participate in the election. And another thing is police station are not set up in every village or every ward that conducted election. So for those who if the police station is not in their village, it will be difficult to travel to another village and, you know, to cast their vote. So this could be some of the reason why the voter turnout is low. And I think military is intentionally it show the incapability of the military, and on the other hand, military maybe intentionally implement this election like that.
Because the reason I ask is because the announcement from the military at the end of December, so after the first phase of the sham election, but before the second phase, was that of the eligible voters, according to the military, 52% mm-hmm. had voted. And this is, again, taking into consideration, as you said, they changed the electoral rolls and they threw a lot of people off the electoral register. So the reason I'm asking is what your opinion is of this 52% number, because it is a very, very low number compared to these high 80%, even mid to high 90% numbers that the military usually provides, which we know are false. We know that they're lying. Mm-hmm. But admitting to a number as low as 52% is very, very uncharacteristic of the military. And this is why I'm wondering, are you saying that even their 52% number, which is very low, is still probably a false number that they are giving to try to make it look like at least half of the people participated?
So that 52% is from which organization?
So that was Reuters reporting that this is what the Tatmadaw had announced.
It may be close to the it may close with the real situation, okay. We can't fully trust, you know.
Of course. I mean, this was Aung Myint Toon, so obviously there's a question with everything he says. But that's a matter. The other one that I wanted to ask, because I think this is a very interesting thing, is what is being done to ensure that the correct people are voting? As one thing that you say, obviously, is you need police stations. But there are a very large number of IDPs. And as we heard in the last episode, you know, IDPs are even more vulnerable than most of the population when it comes to threats of imprisonment or when it comes to threats of being forced into military conscription. But if you're an IDP, you presumably do not have residency documents. You do not have a regular address. Are these things not necessary for someone to be able to participate in an election? Can you, if you're an IDP who has had to travel outside of your township or even outside of your state, are you able, even if you want to participate in the election, are you able to participate in the election? Are you able to say, you know, I'm from Sagaing, even if you are physically located currently in Magwe, can you say, I'm from Sagaing, I'm from this township, I would like to participate in my election? Or will they say, sorry, you are not eligible to vote here?
In our research, we didn't hear such kind of case. In Myanmar, if in the current situations, if we visit to another place or to another village or another township, if we if we move to another place, and if even if we visit to our relative in another village, we have to report our guest information to the local administration office. For example, all the what displaced persons are also register their information and register their information in the local administration office. So and we have to update weekly, or if the or sometimes fortnightly, sometimes weekly, we have to go and report that in our house we have for example 3 guests, 4 guests, something like that. So even though for displaced person, even though they have a proper document, their household information is in the local administration office. So I think before the election, all those all the displaced information of the displaced persons are already in the local respective local administration office, the local authority just included all of the eligible displaced persons in the voter list.
Okay, I want to look at a couple of case studies that you've done. So you noted that they, generally speaking, people are participating in the election, and as you noted, those people who are participating in the majority of cases do not want to be participating. They do not support the election. They don't believe in the election. They are just afraid that they or their families or their businesses will be targeted if they do not participate in the military's election. But you noted that there are a few places. I'm looking at the report here. You note Hakka in Chin State, which you already alluded to in the introduction, but also a village outside of Michina, up in Kachin, and also one village in Sagaing, where the voter turnout was very, very low. Can you tell us about these cases? Why was the voter turnout so low?
So in Hakka, the village that we studied in Michina Township, and yes, in a village in Sagaing, in those areas, the voter turnouts are quite low compared to other regions, because those areas are a contesting area to get control between the resistance force and military regime forces. So we could see that the influence of military regime is relatively less than for example, in the village that we monitor in Michina Township, that village was also included for the election, but practically that village was under the influence of KIA, which is Independence Army. So the people don't care much about the region administration or region election process, because in the village there is an administration office by KIA, and day-to-day administration services are being provided by the KIA. So that is what I want to say. Those are contested areas. So even though people didn't participate in the election, they are less dangerous compared to other area where military is strongly influenced. So you know what I mean?
Mm. Yes. But this is very interesting because these locations were still included in the military's plan for this election. So, of course, we're not saying that the entire township was boycotting the election or just didn't participate. It's as you say, it's not, you know, Michina. It's a specific village just outside of Michina. Same thing, it's a specific village in Sagaing that you looked at, not the entirety of that township. But it is still interesting that there are these regions that the military has included in its three-phase election plan, which are under resistance control or are contested at the very least. Is this the military simply not realizing how little control they have over some of the territories that they have allowed to participate? Because again, to remind everyone, very large swathes of the country have been completely excluded from the electoral process because they are not under the control of the military. So it would be expected that any contested areas would simply be blacklisted and they wouldn't be participating in any phase of this election. Is there a particular reason that these were included? Is it just because they're individual villages within a large township where the military feels it has control? Or did the military just not realize how little control they have here?
Already realized, but you know, they just want to show off international community they just want to show that many part of the country are still under their control. So they are capable to, you know, to implement the election in many part of the country. So I think that's why they just included many contested areas as well in the election.
It's interesting. So let's move forward then. So obviously, the first day of the election, we have the first sort of phase of the election, there are still some irregularities here. So you note, for example, that there's a village in Pao, which had a different electoral process. What can you tell us about that?
Pao village in Dongji Township, Shan State, there was a different election process was formed. So that village was under the direct administration of the PNO, Pao National Organization. So the election was also arranged and organized and conducted by the PNO. In that village, the election took place up to 3 days, and from 26 December to 28 December, and while electronic machine was used in other place of the country, in that village, they use paper ballot. So when I asked the local researcher from that village, our local researcher also don't have exact information. He just said that there is just happened as arranged by the PNO. So I don't know why they use. We don't have exact reason why they use paper ballot, why the whole country is using electronic machine. And the reason for taking up to 3 days, three election days, could be, according to our researcher, could be because, like many other places, in Pao region, the polling station was also consolidated only in some village. Not every village have, you know, a police station. So the village we study, in the village we studied, there was a police station, and you know, the other two or three surrounding people from other two or three surrounding village have to come and vote in that village. So the number of voters are higher than usual, higher than the previous elections. So that could be, according to the local researcher, that could be the reason why it took up to 3 days during the election. Yeah.
And so, going to slightly more broad problems that we saw, and these are not just problems with the first day of voting. These are going to be consistent. Not just the methodology of the voting, but who you can vote for. So this comes through in a couple of different points in your findings. Fundamentally, what the military have done is created an electoral system where the voters do not know who the different political parties are, what they represent. And again, I would just remind people that those of us living in the West, we might be accustomed to having state-run, government-run websites that list all of the political parties and explain who they are and what they do. But again, in significant parts of Myanmar, there is little or inconsistent access to electricity and to the internet. So things like this are not quite as accessible. People are not able to do political research as easily. And so your research is noting that people basically are saying they do not want to vote for USDP, which is the political party associated with the military regime. So people are saying they do not want to vote for USDP, but the parties that they would like to vote for are not on the ballot because of the changes in the electoral rolls and changes in the electoral laws prior to the election. And they are voting for parties that they don't know much about. And you said the one party that comes up here is the National Unity Party, NUP, which sounds a lot like National Unity Government. Can you tell us a little bit what the NUP is? Because your research shows that that far more people voted for the NUP than you would have expected.
NUP is not a new party. It was since, you know, around 1988, the party already existed. And it's actually it's also military affiliated party, but the name is National Unity Party. So people who don't know the history of the history and the background of that NUP party, they generally assume that that is ethnic party or ethnic party, or that would be, you know, that party would prioritize, or that party would work for ethnic issues, something like that, because of the name of the party. Some people get confused, and they just vote a party that includes National Unity. Just name. So actually, it was
as formed, a name.
The National Unity Party was formed since, since before the 1988.
And you've got some direct quotations here, and if I can read from the people that you interviewed, you said that one individual in the way said, and I quote, "I just press the buttons for the other parties, which I do not really know or remember well, because I was only focused on avoiding the lion and the green," which, for context, the lion is a symbol closely associated with the military, and green is the color of the military-associated USDP party. So that obviously indicates that we have a very disproportionate system where people are not voting for political parties, they are voting against the political parties that they recognize as being allied to the military. Mm. The other quote that you have here is from Loiko. I voted for the party that has existed for a long time, Dasanya, because I felt that I had no real choice. I wanted to avoid the Green Party, so USDP, and the party with the ethnic name, which in Myanmar is a very common thing, is closely linked to it. Their leader used to belong to that party and later moved to the Kaya State People's Party. I assumed they were part of the same group and had intentionally split into two parties. That is why I chose the NUP. So again, it seems that the people are going to the polls and they have no idea what these parties are. Nobody has explained it. Nobody has provided them with documents or literature or the necessary information to be able to make an informed decision. And people are voting for parties that are still going to be military affiliated just because they are trying to avoid voting for USDP and they don't realize that all of the options are
bad. People, as you said, people were not informed. How do you say, they were not provided enough information about the political party. And, it was because there was no election campaign like before. In previous election, each political party, contesting in the election, they did a lot of election campaign, both on ground and on social media, so people can know or can see which party is from which party. People can know or can learn which party is working for and which party come from which background, something like that. But in this election, there was no such kind of election campaign, and plus the election related information, including about the political parties, were also not adequately provided to the public. So that's why only people who have some political awareness or some political interest, only such people know the party information.
And I will, because I want to get to day two and day three. I will mention here in passing that you note that a few of the sites, so specifically Hakka, which is the capital of Chin State, Loiko, which is the capital of Kaya State, formerly Kareni State, Michina, Chin State, and Magwe, which is not a state, it is majority Bama area, but it has been very, very heavily contested since early on in the conflict. In all four of these sites, you identified that the residents reported some combination of artillery fire or landmines, landmine explosions, in or near the areas where the election was taking place, that there was in fact active conflict happening nearby to their to the election zones. But I will, as a final thing, I want to ask about the flag, because I think this is a really interesting extra little piece of abuse that the people were subjected to. So you note here that this was specifically in Magwe. This was not a national policy, but in Magwe, public announcements were made that those families who had participated in the voting, which again, as we discussed, participating in the voting is done under coercion. People are afraid that if they choose not to participate in the voting, then they or their families or their businesses will be targeted. And so they are participating in the voting as a means of self-preservation and survival. But the announcement was made that those who had participated in the voting were required to display a national flag on their households. And furthermore, they had to purchase the flag from the local administration, and the price of the flag was 10,000 jat. Now, 10,000 jat back before COVID 10,000 jat for a laborer would be a very reasonable day wage for somebody working at a supermarket stacking shelves. That could be 2 days worth of wages. So 10,000 jat was a reasonable amount of money even back then. So what is the fallout from this decision? Because I would imagine that there are a lot of families, and I'm talking about Yangon. This was happening in Magwe, where salaries are lower. So I would imagine there are a lot of people who simply cannot afford 10,000 jat to buy a flag to put on their house. What is the result of this policy?
The local authority announced this just to pressure the local community. You know, if for example, if those people, those participate in election displays the flag in front of their house, it would be very easy to recognize who did not participate in the election, right? So I think the local authorities just wanted to, you know, impose psychological pressure that everyone, to make sure that everyone, as much as possible, everyone participate in the election. So after the election, we follow up about this case with a researcher from Magwe, but there was no, you know, there was no case that practically taken action because they did not display the flag. So according to that situation, local authority just wanted to impose psychological pressure to participate everyone, to vote everyone in the election.
Wow. Okay. So, I mean, there's just so many layers to this election. I think this is just a really important note to make as we transition from talking about day one to day two, that the election itself, from the international perspective, the election itself is a tool of the military trying to establish a sense of legitimacy. But domestically, the election is a tool of repression. It is a tool of psychological domination, because at every turn, it is the military saying that we can impose our will on you and you have to participate in our sham election, because if you don't, then you will be targeted and your family will be targeted. It's an exercise in control and abuse. And this flag example, as ridiculous as it seems, is just another sort of manifestation of that. But let's then move forward. So the second phase of the election was held on the 11th of January, 2026. And at this point, what we're looking at, if I've understood correctly, is that people don't actually know what the result of the election was, unless, for whatever reason, in that township, USDP had won, in which case that was announced. In those townships, which is the majority of the country, where USDP did not outright win, the election results were not being published. People did not know what had happened. And in addition to this, as you note in your second research document, again, community-based ethnographic study on communities' experiences of the 2025 election, brackets, report on election day of the second phase of election. For those who are interested in reading it, you note that people did not even know where there were going to be elections in phase two and phase three, because, as you say, the military had said there are places where the elections will not be held, and there are places where the elections will be held at some point, but people were not informed whether their township would be part of election phase two or part of election phase three. So considering that there's this lack of knowledge and lack of understanding, what was the result of that? Were people prepared when the government, the local administration comes and says, oh, we're doing the election on this day, Were people prepared for the election? Were people able to go to the election? Or were people stuck in a situation where they were caught completely unaware and they simply said, I can't do the election. I have other commitments.
According to report from our local researchers, some people didn't participate in the election because on election day, they have other job. So that could be, you know, that could be because of they were not informed properly, and you know, yeah. Does it make sense? Do you mean? Should I?
Yeah, absolutely, it does. And so you even note in interviews that you've conducted, because again, just to reiterate that the whole point of the research that we're discussing here is that this is not research that was done externally. This is research done through ethnographic interviews, qualitative data being gathered by actually speaking to the people who experienced this election. What you gather from these interviews is that people didn't even know what the date would be. There was a general understanding that phase two would be on the 11th of January, phase three would be on the 25th of January. But as you note, some people were confused as to whether it was the 25th of January or the 28th. And so people would be spreading different rumors in the markets, in the restaurants. People would just listen to what's going on in the village monastery and hope that the information was correct. So the dissemination of information to the people was incredibly poor. As you noted before, these elections did not have a conventional electoral campaign beforehand where the different parties could barrack and go out and drum up support and share their policies and their identities. And the people, even after phase one, were often not being told what the result of phase one was. Was this a deliberate decision on the part of the military to deny as much information to the people as possible going into the election and between the phases of the election? Or was this simply a matter of military incompetence where they just did not consider actually trying to inform the public?
I think the military, they themselves were also unsure whether they could implement the election in Longlu, for example, in Longlu Township, whether they would implement the election or not is depends on the security situation. So I think they themselves were not also quite sure whether they will be able to implement in such sub conflict affected area. So I think that's why they were not able to provide exact information, exact date and a place when and where the election would be take place. And another thing is, you know, the military regime. The military regime they don't care about the people participation. You know, they just implement it, and they don't care about they do not much care about the voter turnout or people participation. We can say this because, you know, as mentioned earlier, the voter lists are incorrect, and you know they only provide a voting slip to selected individual, and you know they didn't set up or install a police station in every village or every ward. So it's according to this situation, it suggests that they don't care about full people participation. Their intention is just to implement and just to finish this election. So I think that there is also another reason. Mm.
Yeah. I mean, because I would echo what you just said by quoting from your own publication here. You noted that in Mudon Township, which you've alluded to a couple of times, someone who was researching there said, and I quote, "We don't even know for sure whether there will be a polling station in our village or not. There hasn't been any preparation and we haven't heard anything. I went around looking, but I couldn't find one." And this statement was made one day before the election. So even the day before, there was no indication whether or not they would be able to vote. Your commentary on this within the report is, even where elections were supposed to be held, the military junta failed to provide the public with even the most basic information related to the election. Instead, the election appears to have been conducted merely as a formality rather than as a transparent or properly administered process. And it seems a lot of your key findings for day two is that there was barely any coordination or organization, and that even if somebody wanted to participate in the electoral process, in a lot of cases, there were simply no polling places available to them. And even if there were polling places, they were not informed where they could find those polling places. For a military trying to set up an election, quote-unquote election, to manufacture a sense of legitimacy for themselves, this seems childishly incompetent. If the people are not able to participate in the election, even after you threaten them, even when they are afraid, even when you've gone to the trouble of making the election as confusing as possible so that they accidentally vote for military parties because they don't know who those parties are, even then, you would want them to be able to go to polling places and cast their ballots. And it seems that in phase two of the election, they've done nothing to achieve that. Can you explain why the military would be this incompetent and just inattentive and myopic between phase one and phase two?
I think this is their incapability of, it shows their incapability, it may be because of they don't have capacity or they don't have capability to provide such even business information to the public. That could be the first reason. And another reason is, as I mentioned earlier, the military itself doesn't want full participation from the military doesn't want or doesn't care full participation of the public, because as we discussed earlier, many people said that if they are forced to participate in this election, they would choose an ethnic party or independent candidate rather than a USDP party. So maybe the military have concern, if many people come and or if the whole population come and vote for ethnic party or for another party, the election outcome or would be different. So that's why they only arrange to get some participation from some individual. That is what I think.
Yeah, it's very strange. Like, I want to underline what you've just said again. I want to quote from your findings in the report. And your report says, quote, "These conditions further demonstrate the military junta's inability to ensure that all eligible and willing voters could exercise their right to vote. In other words, it is evident that the junta was not concerned with guaranteeing universal access to voting, but instead conducted the election merely as a symbolic or performative exercise, end quote. And this is what strikes me as so mind-numbingly strange, that the military has gone to the trouble, as I say, and as you've demonstrated, of making the electoral process complicated, throwing people that they don't like and don't trust off the electoral rolls, banning political parties that they don't like, taking large parts of the country that they don't control out of the election entirely, so that they could manufacture an election that could in some way, shape, or form potentially actually result in a USDP victory without them having to fake the ballots, which would be unusual for the military. And yet, despite all of that, despite their desire to create this distorted farce of a democratic election, they still did not actually make it so that the election looks like people were able to vote. They did not make sure that everybody has a polling place. They did not provide the people with necessary information. They could have run this election, even though everyone who's participating is being coerced and threatened. They could still have run this election in a way that makes it look like everybody was able to vote. And yet, despite that, they didn't even bother to put in the effort to make it possible for those who wanted to participate in the election to participate in this election. It's difficult to understand the mentality of the military. But I also want to shift focus to the other side of this, something that you've mentioned a few times and I've alluded to, and that is the threat, the coercion. You note in your research that in those, not all areas, but some of the areas during the election period and following the election period, the military has run certain festivals, but also military conscription has increased after the election period. So it seems to be that the military is coming with these dual approaches, partially saying, hey, this election is a good thing. We are going to have festivals. We're going to have celebrations. We want you to associate, you know, the election with safety and celebration, and we want you to see this as a good thing. But also, we are associating the election with conscription into the military, which is what most people in Myanmar are afraid of right now. And that seems to be a not subtle psychological tool, a message to the people. Do this election for us, or we will conscript you into the military. What do you have to say about this approach by the military of organizing these large festivals and celebrations, and also of the increase in military conscription activity in these areas during the election period?
Yeah. I think according to the local research chart, they reported the military regime is intentionally allowing this festival, different kind of festival, to show that, to normalize the situation, you know, that to show off that things are getting normal and people are enjoying their life and everything is going okay. And, you know, that is one reason that why the military regime is gradually, you know, given permission to the people to organize a festival. So another reason is to divide between the civilian and resistance force. You know, resistance young people, many young people are, you know, sacrificing their life and heavy fighting against the military. You know, they are spending their life in the jungle. They are, you know, struggling a very, very challenging life. But on the other hand, people in city, people in towns are, you know, enjoying their life and celebrating festival. So if the if the resistance force see this situation, they would blame that we are fighting against the military for all of our freedom, you know, for all of our freedom, we are fighting against the military in the stay in the jungle, and we are having a very difficult life. But on the other hand, you guys are, you know, enjoying your life. You guys are not participating in this revolution, in this movement. So the military regime would like to divide the people, the civilian and the resistance force. So there could be another reason. And in the way, as mentioned in our report, there are also some assumption that military regime is organizing or allowing people to celebrate festival, because they want to, you know, recruit young people to the military or those who enjoying the festival, you know. So this could be, you know, how to say, there are two or three possible reasons why military is allowing to celebrate the festival after the election. So this situation was particularly found in the Wei township, in the Wei town, the Ningdai region.
Mm.
So do you get what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. Mm. And the final sort of focus that I want to have before we sort of touch on the third phase of this election, the sham election, is the clashes and the violence. So as we mentioned, as the report showed, in four of the townships in the first phase of this election, there were reports of artillery fire and there were reports of landmine explosions. And those regions were either contested sort of Bama regions, so in Magwe, or else they were notably contested ethnic regions like Michina or like Hakka. But for the second phase of the election, what your report also shows is that there was an uptick in fighting around the electoral period. And Mudon Township, as an example, that we mentioned before, that was the township that the day before the election did not know whether or not they would have any polling places around. Mm. In Mudon Township, quote, one of the researchers said, "We heard explosions twice on the day before the election. On the day of the election itself, we heard them four times," end quote. So conflict seems to have intensified around the electoral period. And what I want to understand is, why is this happening? Is this a case of the military trying to crack down on resistance forces around the election period to prevent any violence at polling places, because that would look bad? Or is this a case of resistance forces trying to increase their activity around the election period in order to try to derail the electoral process? Or is it neither of those two things?
Just before the election, in Mudo and Lanlo Township, resistance force attack. Resistance force launched drone attack where police station are supposed to be set up. So, following after such a drone attack from resistance force, a military, military regime troops operate. Military regime troops conducted military operations. So in Mudong case, before the election, a local resistance force conducted drone attack to the village where police station was set up. So after that, you know, the military regime, in response to that drone attack, military regime also fire, you know, fire back with artillery or heavy weapons. So the reason is, you know, the military regime just want to make sure that on election days, they don't want to happen such kind of attack or such kind of fighting. So they wanted to make sure the election happen smoothly or peacefully. So I think that's why they, you know, launched military operation.
Absolutely. And that sort of feeds into the third phase of the election. So this is now 25th of January, 2026, likewise. And as you noted in the key findings, specifically here, we're looking at Laonglong Township. The military wanted this to work. As you're saying, quote, the implementation of elections in Laonglong Township was widely viewed as an attempt by the junta to proceed with elections at any cost. And so it seems that similar to what you were just discussing for stage one and stage two of the election, now here in phase three in Laonglong Township, your report is saying that the military cracked down very aggressively in the areas in and around this township to try to prevent any resistance forces from being able to take action. Can you tell us a little bit about the events of that that crackdown?
Okay. So in Laonglong Township, Laonglong Township is also, you know, since before the coup, there were occasional armed clash, occasional fightings between the local resistance force and military regime. So just before the election, in what happened in Mudo, local resistance force in Laonglong also launched, you know, drone attack to the village that they supposed the police station was set up. So and Laonglong Township is also widely considered to be influenced by the resistance force. So following after the drone attack by the resistance force, the military regime conducted heavy military operation in the, you know, in the village that we monitor, and not only in the village but also the, you know, the surrounding area that we study. So after that, you know, after the operation, number of soldiers were deployed, stationed in that neighboring, you know, in the village that's surrounding, how do you say, in neighboring village, you know, so that implement the election in the village we study. So there was only one police station in the study we village, and the surrounding village has no police station. So they just wanted to make sure that on election day, resistance force cannot able to come and attack to them. So they surrounded they stationed a heavy military influence in the surrounding village, and they under heavy military present under heavy military influence, they just implement the election. They just conduct the election. So during the election period, some people were fleeing their home. They are relocating to safer place, safer location, and even on election day, there was rumor circulated in the leader on the election day, there could be some attacks. So rumors that, suggest that people should go and vote in the morning, in the early morning. So people try to vote, to cast their vote in the early morning. So, you know, it showed that military regime, election was did not happen in a you know, civic environment, but it seemed the, you know, in a battlefield atmosphere, you know. So why people are running away because of the conflict, some people are voting, so and you know, voter turnout is also very, very low. So they don't care about the, you know, to make sure that every eligible person have right to vote. But they just focus, or they just prioritize that they complete election in this area and that area, something like that.
Mm. Absolutely. And sort of doubling down on this theme, right? Obviously, when we have this military presence, and this is what you're saying, it's not just that there's a military operation, but as a fallout of that, there is a heavy military presence. And of course, under those conditions, people are going to feel coerced. People are going to feel like they have no choice but to participate. We've seen some irregularities already. You mentioned in one township, for reasons that nobody seems to understand, they were using paper ballots instead of the new electronic system that a lot of people also have concerns about, because they don't trust the electronic voting system, and very reasonably so. But I want to also look at the advanced voting process, which is something that we did touch on in the first interview that we did, but I do feel that it's worth going through again, because when we see this in reports, when we hear about this advanced voting, we have two things. Either because of United States politics, there are concerns when it comes to advanced voting, because certain politicians in the United States have said that it's an inherently untrustworthy way to vote. And the fear in that case has always been that the people themselves can use advanced voting, can use postal votes, can use all of these mechanisms as a way to fudge the ballots, despite the best attempts of the government to keep the election legitimate. Or we think of advanced voting as it exists in many countries in the West, where you just go to a polling place ahead of the election and you cast your ballot as you would cast your ballot regularly. But in the Myanmar context, advanced voting, if I'm understanding your report correctly, advanced voting often means that government officials will come into your house and hand you a paper ballot that you would be expected to fill out in the presence of government officials, and then hand over to those government officials, who could very easily, even if they're not watching you fill out your ballot, who could very easily leave your house and look at the ballot paper when they're outside and know that it's your ballot paper, because they just came to your house and they just watched you fill it in. So there is no level of protection. Can you tell us a little bit about this, the realities of advanced voting, and how many people would use advanced voting, and why would a person use advanced voting if it is so unsafe to do so?
Yes, such kind of home-based advanced voting didn't happen in previous election, but it just happened in this election, in this sham election. So before, in 2015 or 2020, of course, there were advanced voting process, but you know, people, those who want to cast advanced vote were not required. How to say? The such advanced voting in such previous election were not home based. You know, like what happened in this election, but this is the very first experience that local authorities and government official came to private home and private residence, and you know,
collect adverse voting. So particularly elderly people, they collect advance votes from elderly people in the first round of the election. So it happened, what I mean is a household didn't request for home-based voting, but they just, the local authority or administration, they just did it without, you know, requesting by the elderly people. So I think they want to make sure that, you know, they want to, how do you say, manipulate the advance voting. And and that is what we found in the first round of the election. But in the third round of, in the third phase of the election, as mentioned in the report, the military, the authorities appear reluctant to allow advance voting, you know, and because advance voting is in advance voting process, paper ballot was used, so there was a higher risk of invalid or rejected votes. So maybe that's why they don't want to allow people to cast advance votes in the later phase of the election. And another reason was, you know, according to the researcher from Mandalay, the authority wants larger voter turnout at the police station on election day. So, you know, if many people cast advance vote, there will be less people at police station on election day. So that's why the military authorities seem they are unwilling to allow people to cast advance vote.
But so this is an important question, because you say that this is not how advanced votes have historically been done in Myanmar, and one would hope not. Did people have an understanding, did they have an awareness that if they want to cast their advance ballots, as you say, a lot of elderly people want to cast advance ballots, which makes a lot of sense. If anyone's ever seen an election, a polling place on election day, the lines are very long, that you know, the sun can be very hot. It's not, it can be quite difficult. It can be quite a strain for people who are elderly, people who have, you know, mobility issues, people who have health problems. It makes a lot of sense that a lot of people would want to cast advanced ballots to avoid those long lines standing outside in the sun. Mm-hmm. But did they have an understanding that this would mean that people would come to their house with a ballot paper? Mm-hmm. Or did they just expect that, as is the case in previous elections, they would be able to cast an advance ballot without their privacy and their electoral secrecy being violated?
In the earlier phase of the election, I think they collect home-based advance voting from elderly people, but for young people or for adult people, those who want to cast advance vote, I think they have to go to the respective local administration office, and I think they did the same like we did in previous elections.
Fair. And just on a final point here, I know it's something that we have mentioned a very large number of times throughout this interview and also through the previous interview, and I'm certain that we're going to reiterate this in the third interview, English language interview in this series. But this is something that you note yet again in the report for the third day of voting, which is the level of intimidation. And I want to highlight a specific quotation. So this is from someone in Mandalay, and they were told by an official, quote, "If there is no ink mark on your finger on election day, I won't be able to take responsibility for you," end quote, which, again, for context, to remind people, in countries like Myanmar, the mark of having voted is having indelible ink put onto your finger, which typically stays on the finger for a few days, and is a relatively simple and effective way of preventing people from voting twice. And by extension, this has become a symbol for voting and participating in democracy generally. So what we're seeing here is not the implicit threat, not the level of vague hinting that, well, if you don't participate in the election, maybe your business will be targeted, maybe you will be targeted, maybe your family will be targeted, you know, maybe you'll be arrested, maybe you'll be conscripted into the military. What we have here is an actual government official, an administrator, in fact, saying directly, there is a danger to you if you do not have the ink on your finger demonstrating that you participated in this election. Is that level of overt and brazen threat something that you observed in other townships, or is this a relatively unusual event?
Yep, we also found such kind of threat in Yauri region in the first round of election. Like I mentioned earlier, our researcher who was a CDM participant, he was told to that he was reminded by the administrator that the list of CDM participants are still in the office, and her husband was also in the conscription eligible age list. So we also found that such kind of direct threats to some other area, not only in Mandalay. Mm-hmm. But you know, mostly the punishment or the threat is the consequence. I mean, the what would happen to them is, you know, unsure. The penalty is, you know, the penalty were not officially, you know, announced, but they don't know. They are just unsure that what would happen to them if they do not participate in the election. So the uncertainty itself, you know, became powerful. You know, they are unaware what happened to them. Maybe they are, for example, for the CDM participant case, she didn't exactly know what would happen. She could be arrested, or she could be, you know, what kind of action could be taken to them. They are not sure, but you know, such kind of uncertainty itself became powerful, and it pushed many people to participate in the election.
Absolutely. And I think that comes through very clearly in all of the reporting that Myanography has done on this election, that there is a consistent background of fear that non-participation in the election is going to put a target on your back, and you are going to be singled out for reprisal and revenge, and to set an example to others. And this is in combination with, as your reports have noted, increased violence, military operations around the time of the elections, and a general seemingly willful denial of cursory information to the people, so that they could even prepare for the elections, and so that they could try to do their research for the elections, even if all of the available political parties are bad, because only military allied parties are really allowed. Even then, there doesn't seem to have been any real option for people to make strategic choices and meaningfully impact the outcome of the election. That is something that we're obviously going to delve into in the third episode of the English language version of this series with Mianography.
So as we discuss, people are not interested in this election, and they, because since before the election, it is widely understood that the election outcome has already, you know, the election outcome was already determined. You know, everybody know that only the USDP can secure the victory in this election. That's why many people didn't give attention to this election. Many people was not interested in this election, and they know that whether they vote or not, the USDP party will win. They know that, but you know, after as the election election get closer, and they gradually became to aware that voting could be a safer for option for them. So even though in the beginning, even though people did not did not want to participate in this election or didn't want to cast votes in this election, but you know, they did this because of their safety, their survival. So what I mean is, this is not a democratic they participate in this election because not because they support any political party, or not because they because of their political preference, but because of you know, their survival strategy, because of the, you know, pressure from local authorities or from military. So when we look at the election from outside, we need to, including international community, we need to know the context, the context in the country, you know, the context of the people in Myanmar. So why we need, only when we know the context, we can understand why they participate in this election and what happened, why happened this and that in this election.
Yeah, that's all from me. And thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Given the importance of the topics we cover, it's my firm commitment and guarantee that our podcast feed will never sit behind a paywall, and that all of our episodes will be freely available for all to access. However, just because the episodes are free does not mean there is no cost with producing them. Truth be told, it can sometimes be a bit of a challenge to keep afloat from month to month, and sometimes our limited resources prevent us from taking on the type of content that we'd really like to pursue. So, if you found today's episode of value and would like to help us continue to produce more interviews just like this one, we would greatly appreciate a contribution. You can offer up a small recurring donation through Patreon or PayPal, or explore our other donation options by going to insightmyanmar.org/donation. We also invite you to consider stepping up your level of support by becoming a member. You can learn more about this by going to insightmyanmar.org/membership. Thank you very much for your consideration. Oba yarananda dayananga na yarananya dayarananga poda ba yarananga.